This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Good Behavior by Blake Crouch, performed by Julia Whalen and Blake Crouch. Good Behavior, The Letty Dobesh Chronicles. The bite of conscience, like the bite of a dog into a stone, is a stupidity. Can you give yourself your own evil and your own good and hang your own will over yourself as a law? Friedrich Nietzsche.
A note from Blake Crouch on Good Behavior. Letty Dobesh is hands down the coolest thing creatively that has ever happened to me as a writer. Writing living, breathing people who are multidimensional and feel like someone you actually know is something I strive for. To me, it has always been the hardest part of the job, and I often fall short of the goal. And if I do reach the goal, it's only after draft 7 or 8 of a novel, more an act of attrition than inspiration, a steady forming of the clay. But the inception of Letty was a completely different and singular experience. In March of 2009, I wasn't even thinking about Letty. I had become obsessed with a story idea, a sneakily simple premise. What if, during the course of your daily life, you accidentally got entangled in a contract killing? More specifically, what if you discovered that a contract killer were going to murder someone? Would you intervene? Try to stop it from happening? Go to the police? I tried to attack that idea a half dozen times, but kept striking out. In all my failed attempts to write this story, my protagonist, the person who accidentally gets themselves involved in this mess, would simply go straight to the police, identify the contract killer, and save the target of the hit. End of story. And that didn't strike me as much fun. Kind of a one-note endeavor. The problem? All my protagonists were good people. The first inklings of Letty occurred to me when I started asking myself what kind of character wouldn't or couldn't go straight to the police. I wondered, what if it were someone just out of prison, on parole? Better yet, what if they were actually in the midst of a crime when they discovered this contract killer and his intentions? If that were the case, any attempt to go to the police would implicate them in their petty theft and send them back to prison. The story started to take shape, details beginning to fill themselves in. What if my antihero were robbing hotel rooms at a swanky resort when they overheard the details of this hit being discussed? And with that question, a powerful image suddenly took hold of me. I saw a woman in a red wig hiding in a closet with a duffel bag full of shit she'd spent the day stealing out of hotel rooms. I saw her staring through the slats of the sliding door, watching a man hire another man to kill his wife. It still gives me chills when I think about it, because with that one image, I knew everything about this woman. Her spirit, her fight, her brokenness, her struggles with addiction. I knew she had a son somewhere, who she hadn't seen in years. I knew she'd been in and out of trouble for her entire life, that she was currently living out of a cheap motel room, struggling every day not to kill herself. I knew she was brilliant, inventive, charismatic, self-destructive, a chameleon. I knew she wasn't good or bad. She was authentic, real, on a journey trying to discover who she really was and wanting more than anything to make peace with that woman, even if she didn't fit inside the box society had drawn for her. I loved Letty that moment. It wasn't like creating a character. It was like meeting a great friend for the first time. An instant creative connection. I just knew her. In almost 2 decades of writing, the creation of Letty is one of the few moments of honest inspiration striking me like lightning out of a cloud. The only other moment that comes close is when I discovered the big mystery behind Wayward Pines. I immediately got to work writing the first Letty Dobesh story, The Pain of Others, which I submitted to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Linda Landrigan, the editor at that magazine, chose to publish it in the March 2011 issue. And just like that, the rest of the world could know Letty too. I would go on to write 2 additional Letty novellas in the coming years, in between books in the Wayward Pines trilogy. Her world was a great change of pace. Writing about her was fun. She always followed her gut, and I never knew where she would take me. Beginning in 2012, my life became busy with all things Wayward Pines, the books and the TV show, and I thought I'd seen the last of Letty for a while. But true to her nature, Letty would not go quietly. During the course of making Wayward Pines for Fox, I met a television writer and producer named Chad Hodge, who would become one of my best friends and a huge creative force in my life. Chad wrote the pilot script for Wayward Pines, created that show, and welcomed me into the process along the way. For context, our working relationship, TV writer and author, is generally unheard of in Hollywood, which typically tries to keep the writer of the source material as far removed from the process as possible. Chad and I had such an amazing collaboration working on the first season of Wayward Pines that Chad started perusing the rest of my catalog for another potential project to work on. I told him I had these stories about this woman named Letty Dobesh. I warned him they weren't high-concept sci-fi thrillers like my Wayward Pines books. These were grounded in our world, and the concept was the character. Chad read all the Letty stories and called me a few days later. The way he talked about Letty was the way I felt about her. He thought she was incredibly special and suggested we write a pilot script for this new show together. When Wayward Pines filming wrapped, we began work on the pilot script of what would become Letty's show, building the first episode primarily around The Pain of Others, the story you're about to read. Chad came up with the title for the show, Good Behavior, and in April of 2015, we sold the pilot script and a pitch for 10 episodes to Kevin Reilly at TNT, the same guy who had bought Wayward Pines from us when he ran Fox. Just because you sell a TV show, it doesn't necessarily mean that the show is destined to get made. More often than not, nothing ever happens. We knew that Good Behavior would live or die based on the casting of Letty, and here's where we got extremely lucky. In the summer of 2015, Downton Abbey, one of the most iconic shows of the last decade, was in the process of wrapping up its final season, which meant that one of its stars, Michelle Dockery, Lady Mary, was beginning to consider what her next acting role might be. She read the script and loved Letty the same way Chad and I had. 2 months after that, on the strength of the pilot episode and 3-episode scripts written by Chad and me, TNT officially ordered Good Behavior to series. So what exactly is this book? First and foremost, it's the 3 stories I've written, The Pain of Others, Sunset Key, and Grab. After each novella, I have added some commentary about the work and the show, images, and other additional content from the journey I have taken with Letty. I like to think about it a little like a choose-your-own-adventure. You can feel free to skip the additional content and come back another time or never even look at it. I hope this experiment turns out to be something more, a window into how an idea and a character evolve over time through different media. I had the first notion of Letty in the spring of 2009 in some notebook scribbles. Over the next 7 years, Letty went from an idea to a story to a script to auditions to table reads to a cable television show. Along the way, so many amazing people helped to make her the flawed, irresistible, broken, lovely, and brave character you're about to meet, and who you'll hopefully watch. The best part of this experience is that Letty isn't just mine anymore. She belongs to my co-creator of Good Behavior, Chad Hodge. She belongs to Michelle Dockery, who delivers a devastating performance and takes Letty to places I could never have reached in a million years. She belongs to Charlotte Sealing, the director of the pilot episode, who set the poetic noir tone for the entire series. To Kurt Beach, the production designer. Alonzo Wilson, the costume designer. And literally hundreds of people who worked long days and nights to help us make 10 hours of television about a meth-addicted grifter who meets a contract killer and discovers that he may actually be her path to redemption. This book isn't just 3 stories. It's the idea that a character doesn't only exist in prose. Letty is the amalgamation of prose and scripts and performances and finally, most importantly, the impression she leaves on you. Thank you for reading. Thank you for watching. I hope you enjoy the ride. Blake Crouch, Durango, Colorado, May 3rd, 2016.
The Pain of Others. 1. Letty Dobesh, 5 weeks out of a 9-month bit for felony theft at Fluvanna Correctional Center, straightened the red wig over her short auburn hair, adjusted the oversized Jimmy Choo sunglasses she'd lifted out of a locker 2 days ago at the Asheville Racquet Club, and handed a 20 spot to the cabbie. Want change, miss? He asked. On a $9.75 fare, what does your heart tell you? Past the bellhop and into the Grove Park Inn, carrying a small leather duffel bag, the cloudy autumn day just cool enough to warrant the fires at either end of the lobby, the 14-foot stone hearths sending forth intersecting drafts of warmth. She sat down at a table on the outskirts of the lounge, noting the prickle in the tips of her ears that always started up right before. Adrenaline and fear and a shot of hope, because you never knew what you might find. Better than sex on tweak. The barkeep walked over and she ordered a San Pellegrino with lime, checked her watch as he went back to the bar. 2:58 p.m. An older couple with glasses of wine cuddled on a sofa by the closest fireplace. A man in a navy blazer read a newspaper several tables away. Looked to her like money, top-shelf hair and skin. Must have owned a tanning bed or just returned from the islands. Two men washed windows that overlooked the terrace. All in all, quiet for a Saturday afternoon, and she felt reasonably anonymous, though it didn't really matter. What would be recalled when the police showed up? An attractive 30-something with curly red hair and ridiculous sunglasses. As her watch beeped 3 o'clock, she picked out the sound of approaching footsteps, the barkeep returning with her Pellegrino. He set the sweating glass on the table and pulled a napkin out of his vest pocket. She glanced up, smiled. Good-looking kid, compulsive weightlifter. What do I owe you? On the house, he said. She crushed the lime into the mineral water. Through the windows, she could see the view from the terrace, bright trees under gray sky, downtown Asheville in the near distance, the crest of the Blue Ridge in the far, summits headless under the cloud deck. She sipped her drink and stared at the napkin the barkeep had left on the table. 4 handwritten 4-digit numbers. Took her 30 seconds to memorize them, and a quick look around confirmed what she had hoped. The window washers and the hotel guests remained locked and absorbed in their own worlds. She lifted the napkin and slid the keycard out from underneath it, across the glass tabletop and into her grasp. Then shredded the napkin, sprinkling the pieces into the hissing water. 2. 1 hour later, she fished her phone out of her purse as she stepped off the elevator and onto the 5th floor. The corridor plush and vacant, no housekeeping carts, an ice machine humming around the corner. Down the north wing, Letty flushing with the satisfaction that came when things went pitch perfect. She could have quit now and called it a great haul, her duffel bag sagging with the weight of 3 high-end laptops, $645 in cash, 1 phone, 2 tablets, and 3 fully rated minibars. Standing in front of the closed door of 5212, she dialed the front desk on her stolen phone. Grove Park Inn, how may I direct your call? Room 5212. Certainly. Through the door, she heard the phone ringing, and she let it ring 5 times before ending the call and glancing up and down the corridor. The master key card unlocked the door. 5212 was the modest one of the 4. A single king-size bed, unmade, tiled bathroom with a shower and garden tub, the mirror still beaded with condensation. In the sitting area, an armoire, a love seat, a leather chair, and floor-to-ceiling windows with a $350-a-night view of the Asheville skyline, the mountains, and a golf course, greens and fairways lined with pines and maple trees. A trace of expensive cologne lingered in the air, and the clothes on the bed smelled of cigar smoke. She perused the bedside table drawer, the armoire, the dresser, the drawers under the bathroom sink, the closet, the suitcase, even under the sofa cushions, which occasionally yielded big scores from the rich too cheap or lazy to use the hotel safe. Room 5212 was a bust, nothing but 3 Romeo y Julieta cigars, which she of course pocketed, bonuses for the bellhop and barkeep. On her way out, Letty unzipped her duffel bag and opened the minibar, her phone buzzing as she reached for a 1.5-ounce bottle of Glenlivet 12-year. Press talk.
Yeah. What room you in?
5212.
Get out of there. He's coming back.
She closed the minibar.
How long do I have? I got tied up giving directions. You might not have any time.
She hoisted the duffel bag onto her shoulder, started toward the door, but the unmistakable sound of a key card sliding into the slot stopped her cold. A muffled voice.
I think you've got it upside down.
Letty opened the bifold closet doors and slipped in. With no doorknob on the inside, she had to pull them shut by the slats. People entered the hotel suite. Letty let the duffel bag slide off her shoulder and onto the floor, dug the phone out of her purse, powered it off as the door closed. Through a ribbon of light, she watched two men walk past the closet, one in a navy blazer and khaki slacks, the other wearing a black suit, their faces obscured by the angle of the slats.
Drink, Chase? Jameson, if you've got it.
She heard the minibar open. The man who wasn't named Chase poured the Irish whiskey into a rocks glass and cracked the cap on a bottle of beer, and the men settled themselves in the sitting area. Letty drew in deep breaths, her heart slamming in her chest, her knees soft, as if her legs might buckle at any moment.
Chase, I need to hear you say you've really thought this through, that you're absolutely sure. I am. I only went to Victor when I realized there was no other way. I'm really in a bind. You brought the money? Right here. Mind if I have a look?
Letty heard locks unclasp, what might have been a briefcase opening.
Now, you didn't just run down to your bank, ask for 25 large in $100 bills. I went to Victor. Good. We're still thinking tomorrow, yes? Tomorrow. I understand you have a son. Skylar, he's 7, from a previous marriage. I want you to go out with your son tomorrow morning at 10, buy some gas with a credit card, go to Starbucks, buy a coffee for yourself, a hot chocolate for Skylar, wear a bright shirt, flirt with the barista, be memorable, establish a record of you not being in your house from 10 to noon. And then I just go home? That's right. Can you tell me what you're going to do so I can be prepared? It'd be more natural, your conversations with the police, I mean, if you were truly surprised. I hear you on that, but I'll play it better if I know going in. It's the way I'd prefer it, Arnold. Where does your wife typically shower? Upstairs in the master bath, right off our bedroom. As you're stepping out of the shower, is the toilet close? Yeah, a few feet away. You're going to find her on the floor beside the toilet. Neck broken like she'd slipped getting out of the shower. It happens all the time. Okay.
Chase exhaled.
Okay, that'll work. I like that. Then I just call the police? Call 911. Say you don't know if she's dead, but that she isn't moving. The police won't suspect I did this. They may initially. I don't want that. Then don't have your wife killed. It's not a neat, easy transaction, and you shouldn't do business with anyone who tells you it is. The husband will always be suspected at first, but please understand I am very good at what I do. There will be an autopsy, but assuming you hold it together, it'll be ruled an accident. Now, what does your wife do for a living? Oh, not really anything now. She used to be a registered nurse. Why? Just a little piece of information that helps me to prepare. That manila folder in the briefcase contains a recent photograph of Daphne. Address, house key, floor plan, everything you asked for. And I'll make sure the third window to the right of the front door is unlocked. I'll need your help distracting her while I'm getting inside. I want you to call her at precisely 10:15 a.m. Tell her you can't find your wallet. You got a bedside table? I do. You say you think you might have left it there, and would she please go check? That'll get her upstairs. Give me time to get in. I should write this all down. No, don't write anything down.
The black-suited man rose to his feet.
I'm exhausted. I'm going to grab some shut-eye.
They came toward her, and Letty realized that Chase was the tanned and moneyed specimen she'd seen in the lobby.
Once you walk out the door, Chase, there's no going back. You need to understand that.
She watched them shake hands, and then Arnold opened the door, saw Chase out, came back in and closed and locked the door. He went past the closet and sat down on the end of the bed, pulled off his shoes and his black socks, and, as he sat there rubbing his feet, it occurred to Letty that he still wore his jacket, that he would want to hang it in the closet. Arnold stood and took off his jacket and started toward the closet. The vibration of his phone stopped him. He pulled it out, sighed.
Yeah. No, it's fine.
He unbuttoned his white Oxford shirt. Letty's hands trembled.
The floral pattern, Jim.
He laid his jacket across the dresser and turned his back to the closet.
Remember we talked about this?
His pants fell to his ankles, followed by his boxer shorts. He stepped out of them, climbed onto the bed, and lay on his back, his feet hanging off the end.
No, Jim. With the daffodils.
3. Already 45 minutes late for work, Letty peered through the slats, saw Arnold's chest rising and falling, the man otherwise motionless and perfectly silent. She'd been standing in the same spot for almost 90 minutes, and though she'd abandoned her heels, the closet didn't afford room, with the doors closed, for her to sit down or bend her knees to a sufficient degree of relief. Her legs had been cramping for the last half hour, hamstrings quivering. She lifted her duffel bag, and as she pushed against the closet door, a rivulet of sweat ran down into the corner of her right eye. Blinking through the saltwater sting, she felt the door give, folding in upon itself with a subtle creak. She stepped out into the room, glanced at the bed. Arnold hadn't moved. At the door, she flipped back the inner lock, turned the handle as slowly as she could manage. The click of the retracting deadbolt sounded deafening. She eased the door back and stepped across the threshold. She sat in the lobby, now noisy and crowded with the onset of cocktail hour. In her chair by the fireplace, she stared into the flames that roasted 12-foot logs, the phone in her right hand, finger poised to press talk. She couldn't make the call. She'd rehearsed it 3 times, but it didn't feel right. Hell, she didn't even know Daphne's last name or where the woman lived. Her story would require a leap of faith on the part of the investigating lawman, and when it came to credibility, she held a pair of twos. She couldn't use her real name, and meeting face-to-face with a detective could never happen. Letty had been convicted 3 times, 6 years of cumulative incarceration. Her 4th felony offense, she'd be labeled a habitual criminal offender and entitled to commensurate sentencing guidelines at 4 times the max. She'd die in federal prison. So, seriously, all things considered, what did she care if some rich bitch got her ticket punched? If Letty hadn't hit room 5212 when she did, she'd already be at the diner, flirting for the big tips and still glowing from the afternoon score. She tossed the phone back into her duffel. She should just leave, pretend she'd never heard that conversation. She stole from people, innocent strangers, every chance she got. It never kept her up nights, never put this torque in her gut. She'd get out of there, call in sick to work, buy 2 bottles of Merlot, and head back to her miserable apartment. Maybe read a few chapters of that book she'd found at the thrift store. Self-defeating behaviors. Free yourself from the habits, compulsions, feelings, and attitudes that hold you back. Pass out on the sofa again. And you'll wake up tomorrow morning with a headache, a sour stomach, and a rotten taste in your mouth, and you'll look at yourself in that cracked mirror and hate what you see even more. She cursed loud enough to attract the attention of an older man who dolled himself up for the evening, his eyes glaring at her over the top of the Asheville Citizen Times. She slashed him with a sardonic smile and got up, enraged at herself over this swell of weakness. She took 2 steps. Everything changed. The anger melted. Exhilaration flooding in to take its place. In the emotion and fear of the moment, it had completely escaped her. Room 5212 contained the manila folder with Daphne's photograph and address, but also a briefcase holding $25,000 in cash. Steal the money, steal the folder, save a life. Even as she scrounged around her purse for the master key card, she knew she wouldn't find it. In those first 10 seconds of entry into Arnold's room, she'd set it on the dresser, where, she imagined, it still sat. She could feel the heat spreading through her face. The barkeep and the bellhop, her only contacts at the hotel, were already off shift. There'd be no replacement key card. She started through the lobby, wanting to run, punch through drywall, do something to expend the mounting rage. She'd stopped to calm herself, leaning against one of the timber columns, her head swimming, when, 30 feet away, a bell rang, two brass doors spread apart, and the man named Arnold strode off the elevator, looking casual in blue jeans, cowboy boots, and a sports jacket. She followed his progress, watching him thread his way through the crowd and finally arrive at the entrance to the Sunset Terrace. He spoke with the hostess at the podium, and without even thinking about it, Letty found herself moving toward him, wishing she'd honed her pickpocket skills during one of her stints in prison. She'd known a woman at Fluvanna who had it down so cold she'd once lifted 50 wallets during a single day at Disney World. Arnold's back pockets were hidden under his navy jacket, no bulge visible, but people with sense didn't keep their wallets there. Inner pocket of his jacket, more likely, and she knew enough to know it took scary talent to snatch it from that location. You had to practically collide with the mark, your hands moving at light speed and with utter precision. She didn't have the chops. Arnold stepped away from the hostess podium, and she watched him walk across the lobby into the Great Hall bar, where he slid onto a bar stool and waited to be served. 4. Letty cut in front of a striking couple and elbowed her way to the bar. The stool to Arnold's left sat unoccupied, and she climbed onto it, let the duffel bag drop to her feet. She recognized the scent of his cologne, but she didn't look at him. Watched the barkeep instead, his back to her, mixing what appeared to be a Long Island iced tea, pouring shots from 4 different liquor bottles at once into a pint glass filled with ice. Arnold drank from a long-necked bottle of Coors Light, picking at the label between sips. Something about his hands fascinated Letty, and she kept staring at them out of the corner of her eye. When after 2 minutes the barkeep hadn't come over to take her drink order, she let slip an audible sigh, though in reality she sympathized. The lounge was crowded, and she could tell the guy was doing the best he could. She glanced over at Arnold, thinking he hadn't noticed her predicament, like everyone else, exclusively engaged in his own world. So it startled her when he spoke. "Bartender." And though the word hadn't been shouted, something in its tone implied a command that ought not be ignored. Clearly the barkeep picked up on it too, because he was standing in front of Arnold almost instantaneously, like he'd been summoned.
"Get you another course? Why don't you ask the lady what she wants?" "Sorry, I didn't know she was with you." "She's not. Still deserves a drink before the ice caps melt, don't you think?"
The barkeep emanated a distinct don't-fuck-with-me vibe that gave Letty the feeling he'd probably killed a number in medium security. A hardness in the eyes she recognized, but those eyes deferred to the customer seated to her right, flashing toward her with a kind of disbelief, like they'd grazed something harder than themselves and come away scratched.
"What would you like?"
"Grey Goose martini, little dirty, with a free-range olive."
"You got it."
Now or never. She turned toward Arnold, who'd already turned toward her. The tips of her ears on fire again, she got her first good look at him. 40 years old, she would have guessed. Smooth-shaven, black hair conservatively cropped, his collar just failing to hide the end of a tat, what might have been an erotic finger strangling his neck. Green eyes that exuded not so much hardness as an altogether otherworldly quality. She didn't know if it was Arnold's confidence or arrogance, but under different circumstances, and perhaps even these, she might have felt a strong attraction to the man.
"You're a lifesaver," she said.
He broke into a slight smile.
"Do what I can."
She fell back on her break-into-in-case-of-emergency smile, the one that had disarmed a cop or two, that she'd used to talk her way out of a hotel room in Vegas. "I'm Letty."
"Arnie."
She shook his hand.
"So Letty's short for..."
"Letitia. I know, it's awful."
"No, I like it. Nothing you hear every day."
The barkeep placed a martini in front of Letty, slid a fresh beer to Arnold.
"I got these," Letty said, going for her purse.
"Get out of here."
Arnold reached into his jacket.
"Actually," the barkeep said, "these are on me. Sorry about the wait, guys."
Letty raised her martini by the stem, clinked her glass against the neck of Arnie's bottle.
"Cheers."
"New friends."
They drank.
"So where are you from?"
Arnie asked.
"Recently moved here."
nice town.
It's okay. She could already feel the conversation beginning to strain, climbing toward a stall. I have a confession to make, she said.
What's that?
I shouldn't. You'll think I'm awful.
I already think you're awful. Go for it.
He bumped his shoulder against hers as he said it, and she loved the contact. I'm here for a blind date.
What'd you do, ditch the guy?
No, I'm chickening out. I don't want to go through with it.
You were supposed to meet him in the lobby?
This bar. I got scared. Saw you sitting here. I'm a bad person, I know. Arnold laughed and slugged back the dregs of his first beer.
How do you know I'm not the guy?
Oh, God, are you? He raised his eyebrows as if dragging out the suspense. Finally said,
No, but this poor sap's probably walking around trying to find you. You know what you look like?
General description.
So you want to hide out with me, is that it?
She dusted off her cute, pouty face. If it's not too much trouble. I can't promise to be witty and engaging, but I will get the next round. She sipped her drink, staring him down over the lip of the martini glass, the salt of the olive juice and the vodka burn flaring on the sides of her tongue.
Do you want better?
He said. How's that?
Well, if we're really going to sell this thing, totally throw this guy off your trail, you should probably have dinner with me.
5. They told each other lies over a beautiful meal, Letty becoming a high school English teacher and aspiring novelist. She would rise at 4 every morning and write for 3 hours before driving into work, the book already 500 pages, single-spaced, about a man who bears a strong likeness to a movie star and uses that resemblance to storm the Broadway scene and ultimately Hollywood to comic and tragic ends. Arnold worked for a philanthropist based out of Tampa, Florida, had come to Asheville to investigate and interview the CEO of a research and development think tank that had applied for funding. What exactly are they involved in? Letty asked after the waiter had set down her steak and topped off her wine glass, and she'd sliced into the meat, savoring both the perfection of her medium-rare porterhouse and the impromptu train of bullshit Arnold rattled off about bioinformatics, and cancer applications. They killed 2 bottles of a great Bordeaux, split a chocolate lava cake, and wrapped things up with a pair of cognacs, sharing a couch by a fireplace in the lobby, Letty adding up the 3 martinis, her share of the wine, more than a bottle, and now this Remy Martin, which was going down way too easy. Part of her sounding the alarm, you're letting it get away from you. The rest wondering how fast the bellhop pulling a cart of luggage toward the elevators could score her some tweak, and would Arnold be down for it if he did? In the dull brass doors, she watched her and Arnold's warped reflection. He kissed the back of her neck, those fascinating hands around her waist, which she was too drunk to bother sucking in. They stumbled out onto the 5th floor, and by the time she realized her mistake, there was nothing to be done, having instinctively turned down the north wing toward room 5212, as if she'd been up there before. I have another confession to make, Letty said while Arnold rummaged through the minibar.
What's that?
I'm not a redhead. He glanced over the top of the open door as Letty tugged off her wig. You look upset, she said. He stood up, kicked the door closed with the tip of his boot, and set the bottles of beer on the dresser beside the key card Letty had left behind 4 hours ago. Sauntered toward her in slow, measured steps, stopping less than an inch away, his belt buckle grazing her navel. Are you upset? She slurred. He ran his fingers through her short auburn hair to the base of her neck. She thought she felt his hands tightening around her throat, her carotid artery pulsing against the pressure. Looked up. Green eyes. Suspicion. Lust. She swayed in her heels. He ran his hands down her waist, over the curve of her hips, moved his right hand onto the small of her back and pulled her against him. Music bled through from the next room, something mid-tempo and synthesized from the 80s. Air supply, or worse. They kept dancing after the music had stopped, a mutual drunken stagger, Arnold working them back toward the wall, where his hand fumbled for the light dimmer.
She woke in the middle of the night with a violent thirst, and even lying on a pillow, it felt like someone had caved her skull in while she slept, the red digits of the alarm clock continually descending into place like the endless motion of a barbershop pole. The bulk of a man snored beside her, his rank breath warming the back of her neck. She lay naked with a cover twisted between her legs. Couldn't recall passing out. The events after returning to this room lay in shards of memory. Slamming shots of Absolute out of tiny bottles, a fast, hard fuck that didn't approach the hype. She wondered if she'd said anything to undermine the evening's lies, and just the threat of it, considering the man whose bed she shared, broke a cold sweat across her forehead. She shut her eyes, heard her father's voice, all cigarette growl and whiskey-tongued, which whispered to her on nights like these, lying in the beds of strange men and the darkness spinning, or in a lonely cell, cursing her back to sleep, words that, deep in her heart, she knew were true. 6. Threads of light stole in around the blinds. 9:12 a.m. A line of painful brilliance underscored the bathroom door, the shower rushing on the other side. She sat up in bed and threw back the covers and brought her palms to her temples, pressing against the vibrant ache. Out of bed, onto her feet, listing and nauseated. Stepped into her cashmere tank dress and pulled the straps over her shoulders. Last time she'd seen that leather briefcase full of money, it had been sitting on the floor beside the love seat, but it had since been moved. She got down on her hands and knees and peered under the couch, then under the bed. Nothing. As she opened the closet, Arnold yelled from the shower, "Letty, you up?" The briefcase leaned against the wall on the top shelf inside the closet, and she had to rise on the balls of her feet to grasp it. "Letty," pulled the briefcase down, walked over to the bathroom door. "Yeah, I'm up," she said.
"How do you feel?"
"Like death." She squatted down, fingering the clasps on the briefcase.
"I didn't mention it last night," he said. "But I've got this meeting to go to."
"This morning?"
"Unfortunately."
"Is this with the think tank?"
"Yeah, exactly."
Her thumbs depressed two buttons, the clasps released.
"I wanted to have breakfast with you," she said, and opened the case.
"We could do dinner."
$25,000 in cash didn't look all that impressive, just 5 slim packets of hundos.
"You staying here tonight?"
she asked, lifting one, flipping through the crisp, clean bills, breathing in the ink and the paper.
"I would," he said, "if you wanted to get together again."
The shower cut off. She heard the curtain whisk back, tossed the packet into the briefcase, grabbed the manila folder, leafed through the contents. Floor plan, house key, one page of typewritten notes, and a black and white photograph of a woman who couldn't have been more than a year or two past 30. The shot was candid, or trying to be, Daphne in the foreground, in startling focus, surrounded by clusters of blurry rhododendrons. Her hair long, black, straight, skin preternaturally pale, a remote and icy beauty. Arnold was toweling off now.
"We could definitely meet for dinner tonight,"
Letty said as she scanned the address on the page of notes, 712 Hamlet Court. The tiny motor of an electric razor started up. She closed the briefcase. Her heels lay toppled on the carpet at the foot of the bed, and she stepped into them, slung her duffel bag onto her shoulder.
"Maybe we could grab dinner downtown,"
Arnold said over the whine of his razor.
"I'd like to see more of Asheville."
"Absolutely," she said, lifting the briefcase. "I'll take you bar hopping. I know a few good ones. We'll hit the Westville pub. Great beer bar."
"Now you're talking."
12 feet to the door, to being done with all of this, her biggest score. She turned back the inner lock, reached down for the handle. Arnold said something from the bathroom that she missed. She saw herself slipping out into the corridor, heard the soft click of the door shutting behind her, felt the tension of waiting for the elevator. Letty turned back from the door, returned the briefcase to the closet shelf. Hardest thing she'd ever done. She set her bag down and knocked on the bathroom door.
"Can I come in, Arnie?"
"Yeah."
He turned off the razor as she opened the door, frowned when he saw her, steam rising off his shoulders.
"You're dressed."
I want to go back to my apartment, get a shower there.
You can stay here while I go to my meeting.
I need to let my dog out, get some papers graded. I'll leave my number on the bedside table.
He stepped away from the sink, embraced her, the towel damp around his waist, said,
I can't wait to see you tonight.
And she kissed him like she meant it. 7. Letty ran through the lobby, past the front desk, out into a cool fall morning. She forced a 20 into the bellhop's hand, and he relinquished the car service he'd called for another guest. You know Hamlet Court? She asked when the bellhop had shut her into the back seat of the Lincoln Town Car. The driver glanced back, a light-skinned Haitian with blue eyes.
I will find. You have street number?
712. As he punched the address into the GPS unit, Letty handed a $100 bill into the front seat. I'm sorry, but I need you to speed. Through the streets of the old southern city, the downtown architecture catching early light, City Hall, the Vance Monument, the Basilica of St. Lawrence, where a few churchgoers straggled in for morning mass, and on the outskirts of Letty's perception, secondary to her inner frenzy, a spectrum of Appalachian color, copper hillsides, spotless blue, the Black Mountain summits enameled with rime ice. A classic autumn day in the Swannanoa Valley. They turned onto an oak-lined boulevard, red and gold leaves plastered to the pavement. We're going into Montfort? Letty asked.
That's what the computer says to me.
Hamlet Court was a secluded dead end off the B&B bustle of Montfort Avenue, approximately a half mile long and home to a dozen Victorian mansions. The entrance to 712 stood at the end of the cul-de-sac, through a brick archway just spacious enough to accommodate a single car. Stop the car, Letty said.
I take you all the way up.
I don't want you to take me all the way.
She climbed out of the car at 10:04, hurried to the end of the street and under the archway, glancing at the name on a large black mailbox, Rochefort. The residents sat toward the back of the property, which sloped up across a masterfully landscaped yard shaded with maple and spruce trees, dotted with stone sculptures, fountains, bird baths, angels, and not a leaf to be seen on the pockets of lush green grass. An engine turned over near the house. Letty stepped off the drive and crawled into a thicket of mountain laurel as a boxy Mercedes G-Class rolled past. Through the branches and tinted glass, she glimpsed Chase at the wheel, a young boy in a booster in the back seat. The car ride over had only intensified her nausea, and as the diesel engine faded away, she put her finger down her throat and retched in the leaves. She felt instantly better. Weaker, less drunk, but better. Only when the Mercedes had disappeared did she climb out of the bushes, shivering, shoulders scraped, head pounding with not only a hangover but a new element of suffering, coffee deprivation. She jogged uphill to where the driveway widened and cut a roomy circle back into itself, up the brick steps onto the covered porch, where she rang the doorbell twice, struggling to catch her breath. 10:08 by her phone as footsteps approached from the other side of the door. When it finally opened and Daphne Rochefort stood on the threshold in a lavender terry cloth robe, Letty realized she had given no prior consideration to exactly what she might say to this woman, had thought through and executed getting here, but nothing after.
Yes?
Daphne?
The woman's eyes narrowed. What can I do for you?
Though at face value the words were all southern hospitality, the delivery carried a distinct northern draft. Letty rubbed her bare arms, figured she probably still reeked of alcohol and vomit.
There's a man coming here to kill you.
Pardon?
I know this must sound... You smell like booze. You have to listen to me. I want you off my porch. Please, just... I'm calling the police.
Good, call the police. Daphne retreated to slam the door, but Letty darted forward, planting her right heel across the doorframe.
I'm trying to help you. Just give me 2 minutes.
Letty followed Daphne past the staircase, down a hallway, and into an enormous kitchen full of marble and stainless steel, redolent of chopped onions and cooking eggs. Daphne went to the stove, flipped an omelet, and began to peel a banana.
What's your name?
It's not important.
So talk, she said.
Letty stood across the island from her, light flooding in through the large windows behind the sink, the coffee maker at the end of its brewing cycle, gurgling like it had had its throat cut.
"Here's the Cliff's Notes," Letty said, "because we don't have much time. I went to the Grove Park Inn yesterday. Someone hooked me up with a master key card, tipped me off to which rooms might be worth hitting."
"You're a thief."
"I was in the last room of the day when the guest came back unexpectedly. I had to hide in the closet."
"I'm failing to see..."
"Chase was with him." Daphne stopped slicing the banana. "Your husband gave this man, Arnold, a key to your house, a photo of you, a floor plan, and $25,000 to murder you."
Daphne looked up from the cutting board, her bright black eyes leveled upon Letty like a double-barreled shotgun. Her smile exposed a row of exquisite teeth.
"I want you to leave right now." "You think I'm lying? I didn't want to come here. I had a chance to steal the $25,000 this morning. Could have gone home, had nothing more to do with any of this. You don't know me, but this isn't like me, this selflessness. I've been to prison too many times. I can't take another felony charge. Getting involved in this was a great risk for me."
Daphne took up the knife again, continued cutting the banana. Letty spotted the clock on the microwave.
"I can prove it to you. It's 10:11. In exactly 4 minutes, your husband will call you. He'll tell you he can't find his wallet. He'll ask you to go upstairs to your bedroom and check in his bedside table. If he calls, will you believe me?"
Daphne glanced at the microwave clock, then back at Letty, honest to God fear in her eyes for the first time, a solemn, crushing focus. She nodded, the eggs burning.
"How will he reach you?" Letty asked. "Landline? Cell?"
"My iPhone."
"Can we take the Beamer in the driveway?"
"I'm not leaving with you."
"You don't understand. By the time your husband calls you, it'll be too late. The point of the phone call is to get you upstairs so Arnold can break in."
"You want to leave right now?"
"This second."
Daphne moved the pan to a cold burner and turned off the gas. They walked back down the hall, past a wall adorned with family and individual portraits and a collage of photographs, grinning babies and toddlers. In the foyer, Daphne plucked a set of keys from a ceramic bowl beside a coat rack and opened the front door, the yard brilliant with strands of light that passed through the trees and struck the lawn in splashes of green. 10 steps from the silver Beamer, Letty grabbed Daphne's arm and spun her around with a hard jerk.
"Ouch!" "Back inside."
"Why?"
"There's a car parked halfway up your driveway behind the rhododendron."
They went back up the steps.
"You have the house key?" Letty asked.
They crossed the porch, Daphne struggling with the keys as they arrived at the door, finally sliding the right one into the deadbolt. Back into the house, and Daphne shut the wide oak door after them, relocked the deadbolt, the doorknob, the chain.
"I should check the back door," Daphne said.
"It doesn't matter. He has a key, and Chase left a window open. You have a gun in the house?" Daphne nodded.
"Show me."
Daphne ran up the staircase, Letty kicking off her heels as she followed. By the top of the stairs, her pulse had become a thumping in her temples, exertion and panic. They turned down a hallway, past an office, a bright white studio filled with sunlight and tedious acrylic paintings of mountain scenes, then 2 children's bedrooms that emanated the frozen perfection of unlived-in space. At the end of the hall, French doors opened into a master suite built in the shape of an octagon, the walls rising to a vaulted ceiling that was punctured with skylights. Chirping crickets stopped them both. Daphne withdrew her iPhone from the pocket of her robe and forced a smile that managed to bleed through into her voice.
"Hi, honey. No, it's fine. Upstairs?"
"Sure." Daphne stepped into a walk-in closet, hit the lights. Letty lingered in the doorway, watched her reach through a wall of suits and emerge a moment later with a pump-action shotgun. She mouthed, "Loaded?" Daphne nodded.
"Chase, it's not in here. Want me to check downstairs?"
Letty took the gun from Daphne.
"All right," Daphne said. "You two have fun."
Letty whispered, "Call 911. And while Daphne dialed, Letty flicked off the safety and racked a shell into the chamber. She peered around the corner, down the hall. The house stood silent. She moved out of the closet and into a lavish master bath the size of her apartment, the tile cool on her bare feet. Garden tub, immense stone shower with a chrome fixture 1 foot in diameter, long countertops cut from Italian granite. Letty opened the glass shower door and cranked the handle. Preheated water rained down. The glass steamed. She returned to the bedroom, shutting the door behind her, found Daphne standing just inside the closet.
"Why'd you run the shower?"
she whispered.
"Are the police coming?"
"Yes." Letty killed the lights. "Go crouch down in the corner behind those dresses and turn your phone off." As Daphne retreated into the darkness, Letty pulled the door closed and padded out into the hall, making her way between the easels in the studio to the big windows that overlooked the front yard. The car in the driveway hadn't moved, a black 4Runner. Empty. She walked out into the hall, straining to pick out the whine of approaching sirens. Had the central heat been running, it would have completely escaped her notice, and even in the perfect silence, she still nearly missed it. Just around the corner and several feet down, the faintest groan of hardwood fibers bowing under the weight of a footstep. Letty backpedaled into the studio and stepped behind the open door. Through the crack, she eyed the hall. Arnold appeared without a sound, wearing blue jeans and a fleece pullover. For a second, she thought there must be something wrong with his hands, their paleness, latex gloves. Navy socks with strips of rubber gripping kept his footfalls absolutely silent, and he moved slowly and with great precision down the hall, a black pistol at his side that had been fitted with a long suppressor. Arnold stopped in the doorway of the master suite, waited a full minute. Nothing but the white noise of the shower. In the time it took Letty to step out from behind the door and peek into the hall, Arnold had disappeared. She held the shotgun at waist level and started toward the master suite. The half-speed fog of her hangover was replaced with a throbbing vigilance and a metal taste in the back of her throat that had come only a handful of times in her life. Fights in prison, the three occasions she'd faced a judge to be sentenced, her father's funeral. She entered the master suite again. Steam poured out of the bathroom, and Arnold stood in the doorway with his back to her. She felt lightheaded and weak, unable to summon her voice just yet, not fully committed to the idea of being in this moment. Arnold walked into the steamy bathroom, and Letty edged farther into the room, past the unmade bed and the stair climber, the shotgun trained on Arnold's back through the open doorway, slightly obscured in the mist. "You have a shotgun pointed at your back." He flinched at the sound of her voice. "Don't turn around. Don't move. Drop the gun." Arnold didn't move, but he didn't drop the gun either. "Don't make the mistake of thinking I'll tell you again." It clattered on the tile. "Kick it away from you." The gun slid across the floor, coming to rest against the cabinets under the sink. Letty closed the distance between them, now standing in the bathroom doorway, close enough to smell the remnants of his cologne. "Keep your hands out in front of you and turn around." When he saw her, his eyes betrayed only a glimmer of surprise. "Sit down, Arnold." He sat at the base of the shower as Letty stepped into the bathroom, clouds of mist swirling between them. He said,
"What, are you a cop?"
"I was in your room yesterday afternoon when you and Chase came in. I hid in the closet, heard everything you said."
"So you're a thief. That means we can work this out."
"How's that?"
"Can I get something out of my pocket?"
Slowly. He reached into his fleece jacket, withdrew a set of keys, let them jingle.
"The 4Runner's new. There's a briefcase with $25,000 in cash in the front seat."
"I know about the briefcase."
"I can just go home. That's a good score for you, Letty. Bet you never had a payday like that."
"And you go back to doing what you do?"
He smiled, shook his head.
"The people I work for, if they want someone dead, that person's going to die. It's their will that causes it to happen, not mine. They pull the trigger. I'm just the bullet, the damage. And I'm not the only bullet. So really, Letty, why get yourself tangled up in this? You're a thief, a tweaker. You been to prison?"
"Yeah."
"So why not stay out of the affairs of the spoiled rich? Why do you care so much to interfere, to put yourself at risk, which you've done?"
"Late at night, when you're alone, do you ever feel like somewhere along the way you crossed this line you didn't see, actually sold yourself out?"
Arnold just stared at her as the shower beat down on the stone.
"I thought I was completely lost, Ernie. And then I found myself hiding in that closet in your room, and I saw a chance to go back to the other side of the line."
Letty heard the closet door swing open. Daphne came and stood beside her.
My husband paid you to kill me.
Arnold made no response. Daphne walked over to the sinks, bent down, picked up his gun.
You shouldn't touch that, Daphne. The police are coming.
Not yet, they aren't.
What are you talking about?
You're an ex-con. I don't want you taking any flack, considering you were stealing from the guests of the Grove Park Inn when you got involved. Take his car and his money. I'll call the police after you're gone.
That's your money, Daphne.
No, it's Chase's.
She aimed Arnold's gun at him.
Keys.
He tossed them to Letty.
I don't want to leave you here alone with him, Daphne.
I'll be all right.
She took the shotgun.
I'm not leaving you.
You saved my life, Letty. I'll never forget it. Now go.
8. 5 days later, at 6:01 p.m., Chase Rochefort stepped off the elevator, dressed to the nines in a light gray Copley and a cobalt Oxford, engaged with his iPhone as he breezed through the lobby of the neo-Gothic Jackson building, whose 12th floor housed his law practice, Rochefort, Bloodsworth and Sachs, LLC. The stunning redhead followed him out onto the street, sprouting her umbrella against the drizzly Friday evening, trailed him along South Pack Square to North Market, and then several blocks to the intersection with Woodfin, where Rochefort entered the Sheridan Hotel. He sat at the corner of the Chop House bar, letting his Chilean sea bass turn cold and drinking double Powers on the Rocks with twists of lemon like his life depended on it. Halfway through his sixth, the barstool beside him opened up, and Letty claimed it and ordered a glass of Merlot. While the barkeep poured her wine, Letty reached over, patted Chase's hand, and asked with faux empathy, "How you holding up?" Searched his face for some tell of the preceding week's stress, but no indication presented aside from a darkness under his eyes that had mostly been erased with concealer and the blush of Irish whiskey. He worked up a glassy-eyed smile, slurred,
"We know each other."
"Well, I certainly know you."
The barkeep returned with her wine.
"That's $10. Would you like to start a..."
Chase tapped his chest.
"My tap." "Of course, Mr. Rochefort."
Chase banged his rocks glass against Letty's wine glass and threw back the rest of his whiskey.
"Have I sued you before?"
he asked, excavating the lemon from the melting cubes of ice, crunching the rind between his back molars.
"No, you haven't sued me."
"Good," he grinned.